Good evening. I'm Yumi Wilson, and welcome to City Visions. California's Dream Act. What are the implications for the Bay Area and beyond? At a time when dozens of states are passing anti-immigrant laws, Governor Jerry Brown has just signed a series of bills that sends a clear signal that California isn't about to punish them. Earlier this month, he signed a bill that will allow thousands of undocumented students in California to receive state financial aid to attend public colleges. AB 131, which still faces approval by UC Regents, is set to take effect in 2013. Brown also signed a bill that bans local government from passing laws requiring local businesses use a federal line online databases used to check worker status, and a bill that blocks police from impounding vehicles at a checkpoint because a driver is unlicensed. Supporters say Brown's actions are important acts in the absence of any congressional leadership. The Obama administration recently said it would prioritize who it deports to focus on immigrants convicted of serious crimes. While that is a first and important step, it doesn't replace a federal Dream Act or prevent rogue enforcement efforts. And the Obama administration has yet to shut down the controversial Secure Communities program that has netted thousands of immigrants with no criminal history. The program was created to target immigrants convicted of violent felonies, but has led to the deportation of immigrants with no or minor convictions. What do voters think about the governor's historic actions? Will the cost for taxpayers be too much to bear? Will California's new laws sway the Obama administration into action? Join us tonight here on City Visions, KALW. City Visions is now celebrating its 20th year on local public radio. And we're going to ask these questions. We have some prominent and important guests tonight. Sandra Hernandez is an editorial writer at the Los Angeles Times. She's worked as a staff writer at the LA Daily Journal, covering criminal justice and immigration, and as a staff writer at the South Florida Sun Sentinel, where she covered Latino affairs as well as Latin America and the Caribbean. She's worked as a freelance correspondent in Colombia, Venezuela, and Brazil, writing for the Times, among other places, and was a staff writer at the LA Weekly for 6 years before that. Welcome, Sandra. Peter Orner is an associate professor in creative writing at San Francisco State University. He's the author of a novel, The Second Coming of Mavala Shekongo, and a story collection, Esther Stories. A new novel, Love and Shame and Love, will be out next month. Peter is also the editor of Underground America and Hope Deferred, Narratives of Zimbabwean Lives. Peter was born in Chicago and is a graduate of the University of Michigan. He received a law degree from Northeastern University and an MFA from the University of Iowa. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
Doug Ford is an immigration attorney at the Legal Aid Justice Center in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the director of the Immigration Law Clinic at the law school. He's a coordinator of the Legal Aid Pro Bono Immigration Project, a partnership with the law firm Hunton and Williams and the law school's Mortimer Kaplan Public Service Center. Ford has previously worked as a policy analyst for the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants in Washington, D.C. He's also worked as a senior research associate and deputy director of Bosnia Projects with Physicians for Human Rights. Welcome, Doug.
Hi, welcome.
So I wanted to welcome all three guests. Thank you for joining us tonight on City Visions. In about 30 minutes, less than that, we're going to invite you, the listeners, to join us with your questions and comments. But let me give you the number now. That number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. feel free to drop us an email at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So I wanted to start out the questions tonight by getting kind of an overview. We've heard a lot about this term called California Dream Act. As I was doing a little bit of research, you know, it started to make sense that there are different pieces, different parts of legislation, different measures that have been signed recently by the governor. Sandra Hernandez, can you give us a little bit more about the so-called California Dream Act?
Sure. The Dream Act was, the sponsor is a gentleman by the name of Gil Cedillo, who's been both in the Assembly and in the Senate in the California legislature. And he has really made this sort of the hallmark of his time in office. He's been trying to get the bill through now for several years, and it's this year he sort of split it in half. The first part of it, which is AB 130, was the bill that allowed students, undocumented immigrant students, access to private scholarships in California's state and university systems. Just to give you a sense of what that means, last year the UC system, the University of California system, gave out about $45 million in private scholarships. But because of the way it was constructed, they were barred from allowing undocumented immigrants to apply. So AB 130, which was the first part of the DREAM Act, entitles undocumented students to apply for that. It's still based on merit and all the other qualifications that students have to have. It's not a handout. And then there's AB 131, which was slightly more controversial. That's the part of the California DREAM Act that entitles undocumented immigrants to apply for state aid, not federal aid, but state aid. And there was a study done by the California Department of Finance that estimates that about 2,500 additional students will qualify for these Cal grants at a cost of about $14.5 million. And to give your listeners kind of a context for that, Cal grant programs cost about $1.4 billion. So they are estimating that it's going to be about 1% of all Cal grants will be affected by the DREAM Act.
1% per year or 1%?
I believe that's per year.
Okay. So $14.5 million about in terms of AB 131.
Right.
Okay.
Which is the part of the DREAM Act that's getting all the new attention and right. was just signed this month.
Right. He signed it on a Saturday.
That's correct. One day before his deadline.
It's so interesting to me. Okay. Thank you, Sandra. Peter Orner. So, in talking about the work that you've done, I've been reading a lot of stories, hearing a lot of narratives about students, really. In my role here, I'm a journalism professor at San Francisco State, but I'm hearing from students who say that this is long overdue, that they are top students, you know, really, that no handout, as Sandra mentioned. They are the people who are not only benefiting, but they've been working hard. The families have been working hard for some time. Can you give us more of the picture of you know, sort of like the real people's stories?
Well, yes. I also teach at San Francisco State, as you know, and I think absolutely it's long overdue that students in the state of California are being treated the same all around. And I think it's been way, way too long that students who have an undocumented status for various reasons, very common that their parents came here and crossed the border illegally and brought very young children with them. And those students, those children, and they became students and college students, ended up being penalized for that for years, for decades. And now I think that Jerry Brown and the legislature, both Democratic governor and a Democratic legislator, which is obviously the reason it happened, have finally done the right thing. I think it's important, though, to note that it doesn't change a student's status, that once a student graduates, they're still going to be an undocumented person, which, you know, obviously puts them in a very difficult position in life, in getting jobs, et cetera. But I think it, you know, it's a good day, and I think that I'm proud to be a professor in the California system that is doing right by these students.
My understanding is that the students in receiving either public or private aid will also have to show that they are applying for legal status. Is that correct, Sandra?
I don't think I have not heard that requirement.
Okay.
That's not something. There are other requirements. They have to have attended and graduated from a California high school. They have to have attended for 3 years. Few years ago now, the legislature also provided in-state tuition for them for anybody who had graduated from California high school. So those are really the requirements that have been put in place. But as Peter notes, without a federal companion bill, their future is somewhat limited. They can attend and they can graduate from college, but they still find themselves facing a larger issue.
Let's talk about federal action or inaction. Doug, so where do we stand with the Obama administration? Where do people stand?
Which part of it?
Yeah, well, to any...
With all its complications, do you want to know where they stand on, immigration reform writ large, commonly known as comprehensive immigration reform, last saw a serious effort when, it was headed by some prominent politicians named Bush, McCain, and Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Not exactly the triumvirate you would have expected, and those threesome or their heirs are certainly not on the horizon today. And that was in the waning years of the Bush administration. This past year, we tried to get the Federal Dream Act.
Mm-hmm.
We, in the sense that, being an immigrant advocate and generally supportive of answers to the kind of underclass or gray economy type of situation that comes about from having 11 million undocumented or unauthorized folks. But, as many know, that failed. When there was almost no Republican support for that in Congress, and even not full Democratic support. So on, the fundamental change that is needed to give real, lasting, durable status to the Dreamers, as they're called, but, any undocumented and unauthorized has to go through Congress, and it hasn't happened. There are administrative measures under consideration by the Obama administration that could be helpful to numbers of folks, in the hundreds of thousands, but it still is a very small minority of the overall unauthorized, undocumented population, and that population, administrative measures are only going to do so much. It's really a question of Congress for them.
And in your opinion, do you think there is any chance of this being taken up by Congress?
Well, certainly, take Senator McCain as an example. He was willing to propose compromise legislation at that point about 5 years ago and, veered hard right in his reelection.
Mm-hmm.
And along with many Republicans, even some moderates, some mavericks, can't seem to blend some sort of recognition that you're not going to deport your way out of this problem with the enforcement components that are so wanted by, across a good part of the political and just kind of middle America. But I think a lot of middle America, maybe not the most vocal part, also acknowledges that, there's kind of a human rights element. Mm-hmm. Much of our Constitution is not written in terms of citizens. It's written in terms of persons and people. And, while not expressly protecting people like the undocumented, the kind of spirit of our country and rights is that, there's a certain amount of due process and there's a recognition of the contributions folks like that have made. But as of yet, there's not a formal legal mechanism that allows those folks or, even the idea that they go back and get in some line. There is no line for these people to get into immigration.
I would just break in and say, we have a real political polarization around this issue. And, just Orrin Hatch was one of the co-sponsors of the Federal Dream Act. And where has he been? And I think, we could talk to a blue in the face, I think, about about where we're at in this country. I think, in my opinion, and Sandra, correct me if I'm wrong, but California feels to me like a little bit of an island here. There are a few states that are moving on this: New York, Texas, ironically. But for the most part, I feel like California is a little bit out on a limb compared to other states.
Let's talk a little bit about what other states are doing. I was reading stories, and it seems like other states are doing various things at the moment. Sandra Hernandez, can you give us a sense of what's going on at a national level in terms of states? And
sure. There were probably over 100 bills considered last year, measures rather, across the country. Probably more than half of those, or at least half of those, involved some sort of attempt to restrict or address undocumented immigrants in communities. Certainly, we've all heard in recent days about Alabama's measure, which is billed as the toughest and the harshest immigration bill in the country. And states are sort of taking up the measure, and you're getting a patchwork of laws in the face of Washington's inaction, the complete sort of abdication of any legislative fix has really sort of resulted in states like Arizona, Alabama, Georgia, Utah, et cetera, adopting these measures that focus largely on requiring police to check the immigration status of anyone that they might think is undocumented or who may not be legally in the country. That's given rise to concerns about racial profiling in Alabama. There was a great deal of concern because it was sort of bringing the playground into making schoolhouses, the ground zero for immigration reform. And you had a requirement that all schools check the immigration status of children when they enrolled. Fortunately, that was blocked recently by a 11th Circuit. And California sort of really bucked the trend with this attempt to sort of take another look at it. So I think that's one of the things that makes California stand out, and I think that it really speaks to California's experience with 187, which was so disruptive for those of your listeners who may not remember. That was an initiative that sought to cut off all social services and medical assistance and educational assistance to undocumented immigrants. So I think that California is sort of now going the other way, where we once unfortunately led the country with an initiative that sought to do what a lot of states are doing. We're now going in the other direction, and I think that's a very positive step.
Now, do you think that that's because of the governor, that's because of Jerry Brown? Or do you think it's because the feeling, the climate throughout the state is in that direction?
I think that part of it is the entire country. A lot of the regions where you're in the states where you're seeing these new laws have recently undergone a demographic shift, and you have a bad economy, and sort of the confluence of these creates a lot of fear and concern. Oddly enough, in Alabama, Latinos make up 4% of the population. That's sort of an odd idea that you have this really harsh bill that lawmakers say in Alabama say was intended to help restore jobs that were perceived as being taken by undocumented immigrants, when there's such a small slice of the population. Now, out of that 4%, it's unknown what percentage is undocumented, and I want to be clear about that. But I think in California, California has really oftentimes led the nation in dealing with these issues, and we've sort of undergone a demographic shift here and understand that these are problems that have to be solved as a community. And I think that's one of the things that you hear now from educators, from chiefs of police, and all sorts of public officials who are saying, wait a minute, scapegoating a particular group is not the way to solve these issues.
Well, okay, then this is a good place to, I think, talk about two things. One, secure communities, this has kind of trumped all other documented or written policies in certain cities. The idea is that officers, enforcement, let me read a little bit. For example, in a Mount Vernon story, officials from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, better known as ICE, will speak on the subject. I mean, so everyone's talking about it. What they say in this particular story is most states have adopted the Secure Communities Program, which requires local law enforcement to send the fingerprints of people booked into jail to ICE. The Federal Immigration Enforcement Agency then compares the prints to its database. And I was recently listening to a promo for Frontline, where they interviewed a number of people, and in one case, a woman who was driving, I think it was making a simple turn, she was pulled over by police. They undertook this procedure, and now she may not see her two American daughters who are here legally, and she may be sent back to Mexico, where she left to escape violence. So Right. Let's talk about secure communities a little bit.
Yeah, right. It's a really controversial program, and this March, all 58 counties in California began participating in it. In San Francisco, it's been particularly controversial. The sheriff there, Sheriff Hennessey, has openly expressed his concern. And the reason is simple. It's Secure Communities was rolled out as sort of the centerpiece of the Obama administration's focus on immigration enforcement. You can't deport all 11 million people, and so the idea was you go after the worst, the people who pose a risk to communities. But what the numbers started turning up was a far different picture of who was being deported. About 60% of the 87,000 immigrants that were deported, I think it was in the first year or two, had no criminal or only minor convictions. They were hardly the violent felons that the administration had portrayed these people as, and community started looking at what was going on, and you started hearing a lot of concern from police chiefs saying, wait a minute, this is not good for community policing. We fear that this may have a chilling effect in the immigrant community, and they may not step forward to report crimes or cooperate with us. At which point many communities started realizing that the program, which was once billed or initially billed as voluntary, was in fact not, and that they were now stuck with it.
Okay, that makes sense to me. Peter, in your work with McSweeney's and Voice of Witness, the series, what have you found in your interviews? And then we want to go to invite some callers to join us. Let me give you that number quickly as Peter mulls over the question. The phone number here to join our program and our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. Peter, in your work, what have you found?
I would just say that in my interviews with various undocumented people across the country in the Bay Area and all over California and literally coast to coast, what I found missing from some of the discussions initially, but when I started this work, was that when we talk about undocumented people, we talk about them as if they're some monolithic mass, and you know they all are here for the same reason and all doing the same things. And what I found, and especially as it relates to kids, I found incredibly hardworking families across the board, and in ways that I found absolutely remarkable. And what I think, you know, what's heartening about what has happened in California is there's some, I think, human recognition about the work that people, undocumented people, do, picking our radishes. We have a whole story in our book about how difficult it is to pick radishes because they make the ground all moist, so you have to sort of roll around in absolute slippery mud in order to pick radishes. I mean, things like that, the things that I would never have known had I not sat down with somebody who was undocumented and they told me what their life was like. So now we're talking tonight about the children of people who are pick our radishes. And I think, I think it's what is happening is a positive step. But, you know, when you link this to federal programs like Secure Communities, and in San Francisco we have a sanctuary city law, basically, which attempts to say that, hey, if you're undocumented, we're not going to cooperate with the federal government and have you deported. We're not going to use our funds to do that. Secure communities, unfortunately, conflicts with a philosophical the philosophy of Sanctuary City, which is quite controversial in San Francisco. But I mention this because I feel like in San Francisco and the Bay Area, we have a certain we do take a certain humane approach to this problem. That, again, I'm not saying that I have all the answers to how to solve it, but I think that if we start actually treating people as individuals and talking to them, that's at least one way to start moving in the right direction to try and get out of this complete morass.
Let's invite our first caller, Lorena. You are on the line. Welcome to our program.
Hi.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear.
Great. Thank you for joining our program. So tell us, you've been hearing, hopefully, our guests talk about the idea of a sanctuary city, the idea of not looking at people in terms of, people are looking at the number, the mass, and not looking at the stories of real people and their lives. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that was one of the biggest reasons why I decided to share my story in the book, was that the whole illegal immigrant, quote unquote, it was like a monster. It was this big bad wolf that everyone was supposed to be so afraid of, and nobody was thinking about the families and the children and the people that are parents, and they weren't looking at as like people. We weren't being looked at as undocumented immigrant people. We were being looked at just one big cancer problem, which we're not. I mean, the whole purpose of undocumented, the whole reason why undocumented people aren't here, most of them, and I mean, I guess I should just speak for myself, but is to work very, very hard and to do something better. Not to drain an economy, not to use up any resources, but to be part of a solution and to make a great country even better.
Lorena, can you tell us which book you were interviewed for, Underground America?
Yes.
Okay, so your story is in that book?
Yes.
Okay. And, you know, there's always a risk. Just let me talk from a personal perspective. I'm the daughter of an immigrant. My mother was from Japan. And, you know, as this story unfolds and as I look at myself and really who I am, you know, I'm really, you know, I am a soldier's daughter, but I'm also an immigrant's daughter. My story is very much like your story, or really there is no, we often try to make one group the enemy, per se, and then the other group, well, you guys belong here, blah, blah, blah. And I just think it's interesting because the fact is maybe we're not all so different, and perhaps this is philosophical for a moment. But Lorena, can you talk a little bit more about why you chose to have your story shared in a book and now calling a radio show and talking about what's going on from a personal perspective?
I think my biggest reason was making it known that, you know, I'm not this drain on this economy, and that's the absolute last thing I want to be. And like me, there are many, many, many more thousands of people that are very smart and want to get a college education and want to contribute to this economy and make this country better and cure cancer and cure AIDS and, you know, save a baby's life by being a doctor or help someone by being a lawyer. I wanted people to know that we're not this bad group of people.
So by telling your story, I understand talk a little bit about what you're doing now.
Right now, I've graduated college. I graduated with a biology degree, a bachelor's in biology and a minor in chemistry and Spanish. Unfortunately, in order for me to go any further, I'd have to be fully documented. My goal is to be an ER physician, and unfortunately, right now, I'm at a standstill with my education. But definitely that's not going to be the end of my education. So right now I'm just working and just being a typical American wife and a mother and daughter. And
that's hard work, by the way.
Absolutely.
Okay. Anybody try that job over most other jobs?
I'd much rather do any other job than be doing this. This is the hardest thing in the world.
Great. Lorena, stay with us if you can. I want to remind listeners that you are listening to City Visions tonight. We are on KALW 91.7. Tonight we have with us as guests Peter Orner, Associate Professor of Creative Writing at San Francisco State. We also have Sandra Hernandez joining us, and she is from the Los Angeles Times. She's an editorial writer there. She's had a long career in journalism and covering this very issue. Also with us, Doug Ford. He's an immigration attorney at the Legal Aid Justice Center in Charlottesville, Virginia. And he is giving us a better understanding of what Congress, what the Obama administration, what they are doing or not doing. And which leads me to Doug.
Sure.
So, you know, you had mentioned that the Obama administration is working on certain policies or certain things they can do that won't require congressional action to perhaps move toward a solution or some sort of action that would address the fact that there are so many people who are undocumented in the United States and that they are doing the work that very few others want to do. They are really parts of our society. How do we address that? And can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. If I can just add into a point earlier about the education issues that California is having, just to give more texture to that discussion, is that there are 14 states around the country that allow in-state and kind of residency and tuition for the unauthorized or undocumented students. I believe California may be unique, or there may be only one or two that then have the access to the scholarships and the aid. But, you know, California is among, you know, a minority, but a certain group of states that, you know, arguably are moving in one direction, and then you have Alabama and Arizona and others moving in another direction. So it's an interesting story that has different states and states that you don't necessarily expect being the most, you know, pro-immigrant, you know, Texas, for instance, Utah having in-state tuition. But to move to the federal issue, there was an announcement this summer about the use of discretion. You know, most people are familiar with a prosecutor's ability in a criminal case. Do we charge them for murder one, murder two, manslaughter? You know, what's the evidence say? What's the plea bargain, the deal? You know, a lot of those decisions are what are called prosecutorial discretion. Well, in the immigration context, that discretion is held by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. You know, they hold the power to make the decisions about, you know, are we going to release some people, or are we going to go after, you know, violent criminals in our enforcement actions. And this summer, they specifically included DREAM Act to young people and others who have, you know, suffered abuse or trauma as people that if they did get caught in an enforcement action, you know, they got charged with immigration violation, they ended up in immigration court, were on their way to, you know, potentially to deportation, that they would use prosecutorial discretion. It's a confusing issue because it was announced with much fanfare, at least in a certain circle of immigration advocates. And, you know, people in the immigrant community got a hold of this and said, well, do we have amnesty? Well, no, this is nothing like amnesty or comprehensive immigration reform. It is a potential option for, you know, some, you know, number of thousands that may end up in immigration detention or immigration court proceedings.
Right.
And, you know, it may provide people like Lorena with some measure of security that they won't be sent to, you know, back home to Mexico, Central America, South America, or wherever they're from, because they have said that is not who we're going to go after in the enforcement.
They have said that. That's a discretionary thing.
But exactly, it's a discretionary thing. So each office, each attorney at some level has some of that discretion to use it. And as Sandra pointed out in the statistics on enforcement and deportation, while they're going after the violent criminals, you know, they go after somebody and they're looking for a criminal in, you know, home X on, you know, Smith Street, and there are three other undocumented in that house. Well, that ICE officer on the spot at that moment can take all four.
Exactly.
Or could just take the one.
Seems like
right.
Policy.
So the way Peter that Warner. It was reported in the press almost is like kind of like a dream act by, you know, executive order or something. And that, and what you're saying is exactly that's not what it is.
You know, it was,
but it was definitely
relief if a dream act person actually ended up in detention
right.
in the immigration court.
But that's not how it was sort of presented in the press. From my point of view, it was almost as though, oh, well, this is almost, you know, and I think people were rightfully confused by it, and I think you're clearing it up.
I think, if I may jump in, I think one of the things that this went to was, and it's a good thing, the recognition that, you know, sometimes you'll hear people say, well, why can't we just deport everyone? It's with an estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants here, that's really unrealistic. And I think that it was a wise and sage decision to say, look, we have limited resources. How do we do this in a sane, intelligent way that prioritizes? And I think that's what the Obama administration has attempted to do. And both Peter and Doug are right. This offers a little bit more than sort of an extended limbo for those people who are here, and certainly those folks who are undocumented and living in certain states that have conflicting laws. Then, you know, there really isn't a lot of comfort to be taken there, because these states are taking these kind of radical measures, and while ICE is not supposed to be putting them in deportation proceedings, it really depends on the rank and file and the people you happen to get.
Right. And they can interpret, you know, policy law, you know,
right.
the
and
way
so they, yeah. You may have a decree from up top, but I think the concerns that I've heard and that I know my colleagues who are reporters have heard is that you're getting cases where some people who have no criminal offenses and are just a parent that gets picked up is suddenly put in deportation proceedings, even though there is this administrative decision to prioritize. And in other cases, you know, you have offices that are following the rules.
I just wanted to give out the number again. If you want to join our conversation, if you have a very different point of view, or if you have a similar point of view, join us here on City Visions at 415-841-4134. Again, that number is 415-841-4134. And if you want to drop us an email, you can do that at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Peter, you had wanted to say something?
Well, I feel like what gets lost, and I'm really glad that Lorena was able to call in.
And she's still with us, by the way.
I'm glad, because I think we have more questions for her, I hope. But I feel like, you know, Lorena, who was very generous and very brave to contribute her story to our book, Underground America, I think is somebody that, again, because we're here tonight because of the California Dream Act, is somebody that all those years didn't have the advantage, put herself through college without this. And I feel like there's so many people like Lorena and so many people coming up now that may actually get a better chance. But I feel like in all of our debating, we sometimes forget, you know, who we're talking about.
Lorena.
Yeah.
Peter was just talking about you, so what would you want to say, or what do you want to say now?
I was telling Peter earlier that it almost seems like it's a surreal conversation. I almost can't believe that we're talking about the Dream Act actually passing, and that it actually passed. I feel like we've been fighting for this for so long, and I mean, I don't even remember when I started getting involved and started really fighting for it, and I just kept thinking next year it's going to pass, or next time it's going to pass, and I mean, thanks to so many people next time finally got here. And unfortunately, it didn't help me, but it's going to help so many people. And I just think of all the, there's dozens of people's faces that flash through my head that were just waiting for something like this to happen so that they can keep going, because for some people it's just not possible for them to pay their own tuition. It's just impossible for them. And now they're going to be able to.
Absolutely. Get that. But let me follow up with you. You had mentioned that you are a graduate. Quite impressive, by the way, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So now, though, it sounds like you're a little in limbo.
Right.
Right. So let's talk about that, because it's great that, you know, California has this DREAM Act. It's giving public tuition under AB 31, public scholarships under AB 131, which amounts to about $14.5 million a year. And then you've got AB 130, that is about $45 million in private scholarships. So it's great while people are in school, but what happens next? I mean, what would you like to see? Let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, I know that in the very beginning there was a path to citizenship along with the DREAM Act, and I don't think that part got through. But, I mean, just like how we dreamt that this act would pass and it finally did, that's all we can keep doing is dream and keep fighting and keep voicing our stories and be brave and tell our stories to people like Peter that will listen, and people like Sandra, and call into shows like these and let people know that we're not that people, and we do want to contribute to this country and make it better.
Absolutely. I want to mention here, there is a colleague, I used to work with him at the San Francisco Chronicle, Jose Antonio Vargas, has come out, so to speak, on the issue that he learned in his teen years that the document that he had used to show that he was legal status was not real. He had to make a decision at that moment that he would continue, you know, that kind of sort of lie, if you will. Don't know if that's the right word, but he, you know, went on to great things in journalism. He was part of a team at the Washington Post that won a Pulitzer. And he then went on to a number of major publications, including Huffington Post. Jose has really kind of taken on this dream, if you will, and is talking about coming out, coming forward, and speaking up. And what's been interesting about that is some of the colleagues, some of the people he's worked with, worked for, have said, you know, gosh, you should have told us. We don't know if we want to, you know, if we like that information. I think it's a very courageous act for Jose. But I think it talks larger about the issue of people speaking out, speaking truth, because of the fear that they may face repercussions and consequences that they shouldn't face or they don't want to. Sandra Hernandez, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. It's an interesting dilemma for people. One of the things, especially in California, that you see is what's called a mixed-status family, where one or two of I like to explain it as it's sort of in families where terms like legal and illegal are blurred by blood ties. When your brother, your sister, perhaps your mother is either legally in the country or has U.S. citizenship, you don't really think of your brother or your sister as illegal or undocumented. And so these are the families that we are beginning to see more and more of, and you're hearing a lot of stories. And I know my colleagues at the Los Angeles Times have reported quite a bit on this, on people who face heartbreaking choices of, you know, one relative, perhaps a mother or a father, is ensnared in something like secure communities. What happens to the rest of the family? Immigration is an incredibly complicated issue, and unfortunately it seems like in the past 2 years, it's sort of devolved into a debate that has largely focused on the border and ignored this larger question, which is a very human question, as Lorena
explains, and as some people have suggested, really the history of the United States. This is a history, a country of immigrants, rather. And are we familiar with our own history? And it's a very difficult thing for people to come out, and they don't know what the repercussions might be. So there is, I think, there is a lot of fear in communities right now. I know, there's also even been the flip side of it, which is people are afraid of reporting crimes or talking to the police, just simply because they don't know what that might mean for their family. A simple call to the police might, they're afraid, may land them in jail. So I think that there's a lot of fear. A lot of it may be mistaken or confusion over how these things work, but nonetheless that fear is there. And I think it really speaks to how deep this issue goes, and the fact that we're talking about human lives. You know, as Peter pointed out, sometimes the discussion gets lost with terms like illegal and aliens and so forth, but we're talking about people and a very real issue here in California.
We have about a little bit less than 15 minutes now, so if you do want to call or comment, join us at 415-841-4134. I wanted to talk about, I recently hosted or moderated a debate with the top three candidates running for sheriff at the University of San Francisco, and the candidates talked a little bit about ICE, and in reading some of the previous articles from KQED and other publications and stations, outlets, they are definitely people to ask the question, because although we are talking about it at the policy level, legislation level and all that, or even at the human level, you know, getting the stories, we really, I think, do need to look at law enforcement, because they, as many of the guests pointed out, are the ones who will decide day by day as they do a traffic stop, what should I do? What do I do? What is your take on not just the sheriff's candidates, and this person is going to replace Michael Hennessy, who's been the sheriff for 31 years. And what I found true in comments from Chris Cunney, Paul Miyamoto, and Ross Mercurimi, they all said, you know, Hennessy has been very clear about his stance, his position, his effort to honor the idea of sanctuary city, to not criminalize every person, and certainly not racially profile those. And so what's going to happen at the law enforcement level? And perhaps you can give us some different examples. Peter Orner, can we start with you?
Well, I'll just say that, you know, just in terms of Sheriff Hennessy, the goal in being involved in the community and is so, has been so important to his career, and he had an article in SF Gate where he talks about how he has a real problem with sanctuary secure communities, because it destroys the public trust. If you are trying to, you know, make your community safe, you don't want people to be afraid to report crimes because of their status. And one prime example, and this came up in the book frequently, is that you have let's say you have a domestic dispute, and you have somebody who is beating their wife, and then the wife happens to be undocumented. Do you want her not to be able to call that crime into the police? Is that who we want to be? And you know, law enforcement, I think, I think very much wants that call to be made, and doesn't want a federal issue to get in the way. And I think that those kind of, you know, Sandra was just talking about mixed families and all. I mean, when we're talking about issues on a family level, which is really what immigration is about, is that these kinds of questions. So when law enforcement, you know, knocks on your door, I think the question then becomes is how what kind of relationship is there going to be? Is it going to be because of status there is an inability to, you know, to have free communication? And that's just one example of a great many. I think that I'll just add one small thing is that one of the things that would come up in the interviews that we did frequently was that that because of people's status, they weren't able they didn't feel comfortable going to the police anyway, much less if there was, if there's some external factor for them not to do it. But, you know, generally speaking, undocumented people want to stay away from the police as far as possible anyway.
Hasn't that always been the case, though? I mean, if we look at American history, we'll find that that's true, not just with the Latino community, but we would find that in the Irish community when people first arrived. We would find that in many communities and certainly part of our American history. Peter, do you want to follow up on that?
Sure, I suppose so, yeah. And I'm absolutely sure that's true. And I'm not comfortable with the police myself. We don't necessarily want to be engaged with law enforcement if we don't need to be. And so, you know, I feel like, especially when we're talking about the undocumented community, you know, what I found is that people are no less or more law-abiding than anybody else, and that we need to make a place that is that the community is important, and that we are focusing on our kids. And you know, and if you look at that Alabama law, it's actually asking teachers to check children's immigration status.
Right.
That to me strikes me as, again, that kind of law enforcement coming into a family situation where, you know, this is a real important problem. I'm not saying we shouldn't solve it, but we can't solve it at the law enforcement level if the federal government is broken on this issue.
And full disclosure, I am on an advisory board, criminal justice advisory board at USF with former chief Tony Rivera and many law enforcement officers. It's given me a very different or perhaps a deeper perspective of what law enforcement, what they do. And it's a challenging job because you're right, Peter, that they are trying to follow the law, but they are trying to look at an individual, you know, case by case, you know. But it's hard because it seems like the current policies, you know, to me, and this is just my observation, but even at the state level, even at the federal level, even, you know, is that it really is this attitude, this environment, this time that, you know what, check everybody. Ask the questions. Have right. the teachers say, where are you from? And
right.
Maybe creates wrong, but the sense of do you belong here, really? It seems to me that that's where the environment is heading. Sandra, what do you think?
I think there's definitely, you know, that things are stalled, and unfortunately what you're seeing are the stall and the impasse in Congress sort of playing itself out everywhere. One of the interesting things has been, even those people who really who embrace stricter enforcement have often been frustrated by, for example, by how long it takes to deport someone in mm-hmm. the immigration courts. And that's in part because there are so many cases moving through the immigration court system, and Doug can speak probably better to this than I can, but that have, where people have credible claims. They may have been married to a U.S. citizen and it's just taken so long, or they may have been picked up for a very small offense to which there is a waiver, but they just get thrown into the system, and so there's a backlog. And so the immigration system in this country is broken, and that's a conversation we have yet to have. But unfortunately, as Peter said, the issue is so polarized that we can't have an intelligent, or we have yet to have an intelligent conversation as to how to fix this. And I think as long as that happens, everybody, no matter what you feel about immigration, is going to be frustrated because nothing's being addressed, and certainly not in a realistic way.
Do you think it's ever going to be addressed, Sandra?
I think there have been, oddly enough, you know, the last big, as they like to say, amnesty was under Ronald Reagan, a Republican president.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know what that says. I would hope that, you know, perhaps as the economy improves and other things come into play, that that conversation is restored to a more sane level. But it's certainly, it's very much needed because we have a broken immigration system. I don't think most people will argue that, whether you agree for restricting immigration or for some sort of comprehensive immigration overhaul. You need to fix it.
Let's talk, and let's leave on that because we're running out of time. We have about 5 minutes left, and what I want to do is provide each guest a moment, a little time there to talk about, you know, perhaps from a philosophical or theoretical or overall view perspective of this system is broken. That is clear. What would you suggest, and who would you suggest it to try to begin to fix the system? So think about that for a second. And then I want to first thank Lorena. Lorena, did you want to add anything before the show ends real quick?
I think my biggest thing that I want to get across is that a lot of people in my situation, we understand that it's not going to be an easy fix, and we understand that things have to get done a certain way. And I've never thought that just a full-on amnesty and let everybody, you know, have documentation would be the best thing to do. I understand that there's bad people out there that shouldn't be here, but there's a lot of really good, very extremely intelligent people and kind people and honest, hardworking people that really do deserve to be able to work here and contribute and build a life here like a quote-unquote normal American would.
Absolutely. Lorena, thank you so much for joining our program. Peter, what are your thoughts?
What comes to me as a quick story. One of the narrators in Underground America is a guy named Roberto, and he's a cook in San Francisco. And he, first of all, I would just say, I guess my one thing was just get to know people. Get to know the people that we're talking about. And I think that's at least, you know, it doesn't provide an answer by any means, but I think it starts to humanize the issue and realize that we're talking about families. And just Roberto, who we started to talk to him, and he told a story about how when he was 14 years old, he was washing windows in Mexico City, the skyscrapers, as a 14-year-old. And he made his way to the U.S. when he was 15. So we're talking a very young guy crossing the border and then working in the fields and eventually winding up in San Francisco. And to make a very long Gurr story short, he tried to do it right. He actually went to the authorities and said, here I am, I'm undocumented, I want to apply for status. It ended up being that he actually was able to get a green card, but his family, in the process of his going through the legal way, was deported.
Wow.
Including, his wife was undocumented, but he had U.S. citizen children that went home with her back to Mexico.
Okay, so we only have a couple of minutes. Sandra,
sorry.
No, that's good. That's something that we need to know. Sandra, is there anything you want to quickly add?
No, I'm going to piggyback on Peter's story and simply say that, it's interesting. Until there's a federal fix for this, you're going to see a lot of what you're seeing in a lot of states. And one of the really interesting sort of anecdotal pieces of this is that, this has been billed as saving jobs. It's very interesting. A lot of the people who have mowed the lawns, picked crops, were working in the slaughterhouses. They're not being replaced. And so I think we have to look at this. It's a very complicated issue.
Doug, I apologize, but we are running out of time. You can tell by the music, which is lovely. But Doug, quickly, is there a website people should go to check out what you're doing, the work?
I had a panicked a Latino kid called me just last week. He was beat up and didn't want to talk to the authorities. We have to confront this fear. And broadly, I'd say we need to think about immigration as economic and foreign relations policy and not as security policy.
Absolutely. All right. I want to thank our guest tonight, Sandra Hernandez, an editorial writer at the LA Times, Peter Orner, an associate professor in creative writing at SF State, author of Second Coming of Mavala Shikungo, Esther Stories, and Love and Shame and Love, Doug Ford, immigration attorney at the Legal Aid Justice Center in Charlottesville, Virginia. Thank you again to all my guests tonight for a great show. This was City Visions, KALW 91.7.